People around the world are living healthier, longer lives thanks to the work of our guest. He founded Project Echo, which provides training and mentoring that results in patients having access to the highest quality healthcare.
If we are willing to democratize our expertise and work together as interconnected set of providers, we can rapidly improve the U.S. healthcare system.
Dr. Sanjeev Arora recently retired from his role leading Project Echo, but he has important lessons to share with us about how we ensure that we're reaching every person with the best healthcare.
And I know that your organization was actually playing a leading role, because what I found very unique in your organization was this complete desire to be the most innovative community health center in the world.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Dr. Arora, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's
so good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you for this great honor, Mark and Margaret. And I've been a long admirer of your work and also this podcast.
Oh, that's great. You know, it's been too long.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've talked to you in between the times that you were here in 2011. But we know you so well. Certainly, our community health center was the first of the federally qualified health centers to operate its own Project Echo clinic. We couldn't have gotten there without you, without your incredible leadership. And, you know, these echoes were really designed to meet the needs of safety net primary care providers in their communities, not only in our communities, but all across the globe. I'm wondering if you could just take our audience back to the original vision for Project Echo. Where did you get the idea?
Yeah, you know, I'm a gastroenterologist by profession, and what was happening was that I was practicing in the University of New Mexico, where I'm a professor, in 2001. I'm a professor there, and I was an expert in hepatitis C, and I saw a patient who was 43 years old, and she had two children in the room, a 14-year-old boy and a 9-year-old girl, and I asked her, how can I help you? And she said, I have hepatitis C and I want treatment. And I said, of course, we'll do that. How long have you had it? And she said, I've had it for 8 years. So I said, why did you not come earlier for treatment? I've been here. And she said, I've called your nurse and there was an 8-month wait to see you. And I would have to drive 200 miles each way, make 12 trips while I was getting these injections and pills and with all these side effects, and I can't take so much time off work because I'm a single mother. So I said, okay, what made you come today? And she said, I'm having pain here in the right upper side of my abdomen, which hepatitis C doesn't cause pain in itself. And I did an ultrasound and I found a cancer of her liver this big. And it was too late and she passed away. And I was asking myself, why did she die of a disease that was potentially curable? And now we have these two children who are going to be missing their mother. And the challenge I was facing was there were 28,000 hepatitis C patients in New Mexico that had been diagnosed and the state health department had their names, but only 1,500 had been treated. And as I mentioned, I had an 8-month wait to see me and I was working all the time. And I said, this is an insoluble problem unless we change the way this delivery system is working, and particularly difficult for underserved patients, because the people with full insurance and lots of resources were able to somehow get access. But it was the lower income people who couldn't. So it's at that time I came up with the idea of Project Echo. I was meditating in December 2002, asking this question, how can we, you know, what should I do to be of service? And this idea came to me. Mm-hmm. And the model was based on the idea of democratizing my expertise. And
wonderful.
That's how it was born, yeah.
Well, that is a great story. We certainly remember our first Project Echo session here after we'd read about you, gone to learn from you. Dr. Anderson came back and launched it. But I think the radical idea in your democratizing of healthcare from the healthcare system point of view might have been that you decided that the answer was primary care, and that it was the primary care providers who would be the instruments of this democratizing and bringing healthcare to people who needed. I wonder if you could, you know, before we talk more about the future, just take us back to that for a moment and how you navigated the engagement of the healthcare community and saying primary care needs to step up and into this and we can support them. Tell us a little bit that part of the story.
You know, for a long time, I had this intuitive feeling that there was no solution to this healthcare system's challenges of low quality, high cost, and poor access, which I call three big, big problems. And there was no easy solution to this problem unless we made primary care the center of this care delivery system. That means it was not possible to envision a system where a patient would go from specialist to specialist to specialist, figuring out whom she needed, what specialist is the next one, and then who coordinates all the care between. There was just no other theoretical way. In my case, there was an additional problem. There was a dire shortage of specialists, and that hasn't changed yet. Mm-hmm. Even today, 22 years after I started Echo, for underserved patients in this country, access to care, specialty care, is very, very hard. It's like, you know, all the airplanes, these are specialist appointments, are full with fully paid patients. And so it's very difficult for underserved patients mm-hmm. to actually squeeze in to those seats. And it's really sad to see what is happening. And so what I was seeing was, Margaret, was that there was a very large scale problem in that knowledge was increasing at an exponential pace. And there was need for specialty expertise, but there was no way they could be just, we would need 10, 20 times the number of specialists, and it wasn't. Whereas in primary care, there were a few very common diseases which they saw so much of. The Pareto's principle was in effect. Mm-hmm. That is, 20% of the diseases accounted for about 80% of morbidity, mortality, deaths. And if we were able to democratize our expertise to empower them to take care, then only those patients that truly needed highly specialized expertise would need to go to specialists. Mm-hmm. And care would be provided closer to home at a lower cost by providers they knew and trusted.
Well, it's kind of interesting. The democratizing of healthcare had a simple model behind it, a hub and spoke structure, because you've got a lot of people out in rural areas, but you have the technology or the expertise in one particular area. And I really find that hub being a force multiplier, right? It really just strengthened wherever people were at the distance. Just talk a little bit, explain how that worked and why it really it's fundamental to the success that you've had.
Yeah, no, I think, Mark, you absolutely hit the nail on the head here. The reason why Echo works is because it's a force multiplier. For the more than 8 billion people in the world, 85% of them don't have access to specialty care. So to even imagine a solution that will help them all, one would need force multiplication. And the way I define that in healthcare is an exponential improvement in capacity to deliver best practice care, 10 times, not just doubling, but going tenfold. And so the way Echo worked was, it was based on four key ideas. One was to use technology to leverage expertise. And there was no Zoom at that time in 2003 when I started.
Hard to believe.
Yeah. But we bought a used Polycom bridge.
Right.
I paid $25,000 for it, put it in the basement, and created something like Zoom for about 25 people. That's the max that could come. The second key idea was to share best practices. So I went to primary care and I said, look, this is how you treat hepatitis C. But they said, no, this is sort of a little bit of chemotherapy here. You can't just give us lectures and we just do it. And it occurred to me that whenever there's a dynamically complex problem, like treating a patient with hepatitis C or complex diabetes, you need guided practice. That's how we train doctors. So that brought me to the third principle. I was saying, how did you become a specialist? When I was doing my fellowship, I would see a patient present to my professor, see another one professor. And after 2 years, they said, you're a gastroenterologist. I said, aha, I'm going to create new hepatitis C-ologists in New Mexico. And I told them, if you could just join me once a week for an hour or so and present cases to each other and to me and my psychiatrist, that we will help you manage these patients, in a sense, hold your hands as you first crawl and then walk and then run.
Learn one, do and one, teach one, right?
Yes, exactly. And so, so as we did that week after week, in 1 year they became experts, and in 18 months the wait in my clinic actually fell to from 8 months to 2 weeks. And we knew over the next many years, we treated thousands and thousands of patients that we had stumbled upon a model that could be very helpful for people all over the world.
Well, you were 100% correct. And as we think about that, we were so focused on hepatitis C at that moment when we read about this work, because we were dealing with it as everyone around the United States was, not just in New Mexico, but was really transformative to us was that moment in time also brought us the opioid epidemic, the challenge of how do we now manage chronic pain when the opioids are no longer. We clearly know that it's unsafe to use them in most situations. We were still dealing with the HIV crisis. Tell us a little bit about how you took it then from a model that was highly effective with hepatitis C to make it a kind of a solution to all of the complex problems that we address in primary care, if we can train new providers coming into the practices to this model, because no surprise to anybody, people did not sign up for primary care thinking they would necessarily be managing these. So tell us a little bit about that transition from the hepatitis C focus to all of the other conditions that you then began to lead teams in.
Yeah, I mean, the first important issue observation was that a lot of people with hepatitis C had addiction as the underlying issue. And not treating that, often addiction was associated with mental health disorders.
Mm-hmm.
So in the very first echo clinics, we found that having a multidisciplinary team, upskilling these general practice providers would be necessary, because primary care providers were not so interested in treating disease. They were interested in managing patients. And to manage a patient, you have to provide a comprehensive solution. So we started that, but we had no money. But in 2004, I got a grant, and we did a study to prove that primary care could do as good a job. We ultimately found they were better than specialists. Because deep care was close to their home by doctors whom they knew and trust, et cetera, as long as they were mentored and supported. But then, and this paper was ultimately published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2011, showing that primary care could do as good a job as specialty. That was a game changer for us. But in the meantime, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation had come up with a global competition called Disruptive Innovations in Healthcare that can change healthcare globally. This was around 2008. And it was sponsored by the Ashoka Foundation and Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. But the money for the competition was coming from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And we were one of three winners of this competition. And ultimately, they gave us a $5 million grant to prove two things. One was, could it be applied to different diseases which were still fitting within the Pareto's principle, that where they were the most common complex problems, the 20% of the diseases that account for most of the problems that occur? And could we upskill primary care in those setting, for those common problems? And the second was, could it be replicated to other states, or was it just a New Mexico specific thing? And so we got this grant and we started working on it. And the first one we started was mental health disorders. Mm-hmm. Then we started a chronic pain one.
Right.
Then we started diabetes. And I know that your organization was actually playing a leading role, because what I found very unique in your organization was this complete desire to be the most innovative community health center in the world. And you were. That you immediately saw the potential for force multiplication, that one of your clinicians had chronic pain expertise, if I recall. Another one had hepatitis C expertise. And you started upskilling. It was a really wonderful example for me that this is not just a specialist-focused thing. Primary care finds this helpful. So it wasn't just about disease outcomes.
Right.
Because my wife is a primary care clinician, and they are an embattled lot. There's a lot of pressure on them. And one of our goals was to produce joy of work for them. And so in our initial studies, we published lots of papers. Now we have 700 peer-reviewed publications for ECHO. But the earliest ones we showed that ECHO was producing joy of work for them, reducing their isolation, increasing their satisfaction. And it was doing it by building communities of practice. So,
well, those community of practice, certainly here, and I know with Dr. Aurora, are groups who are intellectually restless, and you found them all over the globe. I'm glad we found you in that same spirit. But Margaret, you were talking a little earlier about Zoom hadn't come around, and Dr. Aurora was saying things that are game changers. And I'm just wondering, if we look back at the COVID-19 pandemic, where the whole world started to change in terms of healthcare, and we had the means to communicate with so many different people that we never had exercised that muscle. I'm wondering if you could just share again with our listeners how Project ECHO met the needs of patients who really at that point had limited access to specialists.
Yeah, what happened as the world shut down, we already had done something that I had met with Eric Wan, who was the founder of Zoom, yeah, and told him, look, we want to change the world. And he had given us an unlimited Zoom license for the whole world, that I could give Zoom licenses to other universities and not-for-profits. And we were giving thousands of them out. And what we found, and so that was one thing that was in place. The second thing that was in place was ECHO was going on for diseases like diabetes and chronic pain and mental health disorders and so on for about 70 different disease conditions in 190 countries, okay? And as soon as the pandemic came, we put out a call basically that, look, temporarily you can shut down all your ECHOs, focus. Just, you already have primary care clinicians who have their time blocked on calendars, right? Once a week, once every 2 weeks. Let's do a switch and use COVID-19 as your subject. Let's try and save lives. And I know you used it extensively, ECHO, for COVID-19. Mm-hmm. But so did, more than 1,100 hubs at that time. Currently, we have more than 1,400 hubs like Community Health Center, Inc., all over the world, the leading universities in more than 70 countries, actually. But the learners now are in more than 200 countries, territories, areas, and millions of them. And ECHO has now impacted more than 200 million patients. But it would not have spread so quickly unless what Mark was talking about happened. COVID came along and entire governments didn't have the money for Zoom licenses. We provided the Zoom licenses to them and the ECHO training for whole countries.
Yeah.
The entire COVID program for a country like India ran on ECHO Zoom licenses. And so I think it just happened to be there. And then, of course, as you know, you participated in the nursing home project with us, where what was happening was too many deaths were occurring in nursing homes in the US, and ECHO was used very, very successfully with a federal grant to train nursing home personnel how to diagnose it, how to prevent it from spreading in the nursing home, how to treat it, how to prevent hospitalization, and so on. So it's been a blessing to see how the model has been able to help many, many people. And I'm, of course, very grateful to you for being such early adopters.
Well, creating that platform, let us all be very creative. And I think one of the most unanticipated outcomes, Dr. Rohrer, that I have seen, and I referenced this really briefly, but I want to shine a little bit of a spotlight on it, is community health centers serve such a vital function in this country and overseas analogous systems. But 31 million people, or 35, I think now, million people cared for in a health center. Workforce, always an issue. To bring new physicians, new nurse practitioners, new PAs, new nurses into this setting and say, you have the opportunity to care for a amazingly, wonderfully diverse group of patients. And by the way, you will be caring for people whose health challenges include HIV or AIDS or substance use disorder, chronic pain, the diabetes, all these other things. To be able to offer this up as a platform that a new provider, not the 20-year experienced person who just needs some additional work, but the new provider can become expert through the case-based discussions, through being part of a team, has really been transformative. And I wonder if you have seen that as a lasting imprint on the landscape, certainly in New Mexico, but also around the world in your travels, that this is transformative for the workforce. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think your organization led the way in it. But ultimately, two things happened. One thing was we realized that ECHO was just a model. Our mission was to improve healthcare for underserved populations. So we had to ask the question, who is providing healthcare for underserved populations? The vast majority in the United States was community health centers and or church-related, you know, other not-for-profits. And in other Africa and India, et cetera, it was mostly governments. So the learners in ECHO are predominantly in these two categories. If they're not private practice doctors who typically, because our focus is on underserved people. But as you pointed out, and you innovated on this area, that it could be a very powerful recruitment retention tool. Because primary care clinicians are seeing patients one after the other. And when an organization tells them, we are also very interested in your personal development and your growth of your knowledge, and we will give you mentorship. So in many, many parts of this country, the word got around, and primary care would tell community health centers that we would only work for you if you gave us 1 hour a week or 2 hours a week to participate in ECHO. So what you innovated on actually became a practice all over the United States in many places.
Yeah.
Because this was also a break from them, from this continuous RVU juggernaut that is really hurting primary care.
You know, beyond the United States, when Dr. Arora mentions being in 200 countries, I think of Dr. Venkataswamy in India and Aravind. And really, the complexity, I think our listeners should understand, for Dr. Arora to be in all those countries where there's really no borders in terms of trying to meet the needs. It's a global initiative, and we're so proud to know you to do that. And I want to talk a little bit about India, because, and maybe you could tell us about the outcomes you see from your mental health training in India, but tell us a little bit about the work you've done there as well.
Yeah, so, you know, in India, there is a very, very large mental health problem in patients who don't have any access to mental health care. They could be in many states like Bihar and northern India.
And, poorest.
There could be one psychiatrist for hundreds of thousands of patients. Mm-hmm. Suicide rates are high amongst young farmers, for example, mm-hmm. in India. Similarly, often people try and manage this depression or anxiety with alcohol. And so all of this gets mixed, and there's no access to specialty care. So we partnered with the government of India. And so ECHO became a part of the Mental Health National Plan. And we partnered with the National Institute of Mental Health and Neurosciences in Bangalore, India, and then with other academic centers all over India to democratize care for the, what I would say, the basic mental health disorders, which would be depression, anxiety, early diagnosis, suicidal tendencies, diagnosis of bipolar disorder. You don't necessarily have to know how to treat it completely. But just these things account for such a large number of patients that what we saw in the, that as soon as we put these echoes in there, the number of each clinician that we trained. So in one outcome study where 22 clinicians were trained on mental health disorders, in 1 year, they saw 22,000 mental health patients and treated them. It was, the force multiplication was so amazing. And this is not a one-year deal. Once they participate in a 1 year of ECHO and get certification, which all their life, they're treating more and more patients. So this was just data collected for 1 year. So the impact, and then studies were done to show that these patients benefited profoundly because of this lack of access, and medicines which had never been used before got used in the community. And it was, and so in many, many disease areas, we have strong patient outcome studies like hepatitis C, like diabetes, complex diabetes, prevention of cardiovascular illness, etc.
Well, Dr. Arora, we want to thank you for joining us today. We want to thank you for your commitment and your service. We're honored, really, to call you a friend and a colleague. We look forward to potentially the opportunity to continue to work with you. And if you would like to say any last words to our audience to leave them with about your best advice to carrying this work forward, we'd love to give you an opportunity to do that.
Well, thank you, Margaret. And first of all, thank you for this great privilege to be interviewed by the two of you. I've been a long time admirer of your work and your leadership in primary care. So my gratitude for that. I think the one key message is the never doubt that a small group of dedicated people in the world can change the world. It's, indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. And so I know there is tends to be a lot of negativity about the US healthcare system. But we have so much expertise here that if we were just to think differently, instead of monopolizing knowledge for either money or fame or power or whatever other reason, if we are willing to democratize our expertise and work together as interconnected set of providers, we can rapidly improve the US healthcare system, improve rural healthcare, improve care for underserved populations. The workforce is there, but if a primary care clinician doesn't know what to do, it creates a lot of inefficiency in the system, mm-hmm. unnecessary specialty visits, unnecessary cost, and so on and so forth. So I'm hopeful that with the leadership of people like you, we will be able to get to a way where the role of a specialist is not to just see patients, but to really step up and join this force to democratize expertise.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Peace. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.